The new exhibition at the Hunter Museum of American Art is Seeking the Spiritual, the Visionary Art of Elliot Dangerfield. A portion of his work is on view through February 21st, 2016. I'm joined by Associate Curator Miranda Hofeld on a tour of the exhibit prior to opening on December 4th. So when you first walk in, Seeking the Spiritual, the Visionary Art of Elliot Dangerfield, the layout's a little bit different than usual for your temporary exhibits. Mm-hmm. You're not having to go through a separate little hallway. You're immediately in with the exhibits. Mm-hmm.
The exhibition is really divided into three areas: landscape, what we call religious painting, and also allegorical art. And so what I wanted to do when you entered into the exhibition was give you a taste of all three. So you've got landscape on this wall, you have allegorical art right in front of us with the Mystic Brim painting, and then if you look slightly to your right, you can see an allegorical painting of the Grand Canyon, and it's called The Genius of the Canyon. And we'll talk a little bit more about what a genius is and what that means.
Most of the colors I'm seeing are very rich.
There
are jewel tones, and in some of the art, it almost looks like movement because of the way the trees are kind of slanted and the clouds are involved. Where was Dangerfield getting some of this influence?
Well, there are a number of influences, actually. Dangerfield was born, actually, in Harper's Ferry, what was Virginia, back in 1859. He had the artistic bug from childhood, but he actually moved to New York City in 1881, where he studied art with a painter by the name of Walter Saderly. And it's there that he began to do drawing. And so Saderly really influenced his interest in drawing and form. In 1884, he moves to a studio that's right next door to the painter George Ennis. And George Ennis introduces him to the Barbizon School and this kind of notion that art can really embody the spiritual. And even in a landscape, you can look at that landscape and use your imagination and your intuition to feel the mood and the spirituality that kind of animates the material realm. The third influence is actually the Italian Renaissance, and that's where those jeweled colors come from. He's looking at painters like Titian, and in fact, if you look at the Genius of the Canyon, the reclining nude with the red drapery beneath her is right out of a Titian painting. So those three influences are really what forms Dangerfield as an artist.
This one here has got my attention. It's a seascape, obviously motion in the sea with white caps splashing against a cliff. The tree in the painting has obviously weathered a lot of wind, and it's either a sunset or a sunrise because of the colors in the background. What's this one called?
This painting is called The Lone Cypress, and it dates to around 1914. Dangerfield in 1911 was actually commissioned by the Santa Fe Railroad to go out west to paint the Grand Canyon. And he was so inspired by the West that he went further. And this painting is actually of the California coastline that he took his family to. And again, we see these kind of strong spiritual overtones in the piece, where he's got this crashing, thunderous ocean, the tree twisted by this powerful force, and then all of this craggy rock and landscape kind of overwhelming the tiny little human figures that you see. So this idea of God's hand in nature was something he was really after in his paintings.
In his style of painting, you can see layer upon layer of paint. In some cases, it almost looks like it's standing up from the canvas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of the things we call scumbling in a paint. And he's actually, as you said, building up layers, but also scraping a little bit to get this kind of patina to the picture. He's very interested in this painting of creating that rough surface, which complements the wildness of the subject matter.
There are two different paintings that have kind of the reclining nude and the red drapery. One of them looks much more detailed, almost more Baroque. Mm-hmm. And then the other one seems to be almost like it's unfinished.
You're quite right. The Sleepers of the Canyon, which actually shows a reclining nude asleep, along with a variety of both female nudes and male nudes. I just mentioned this interest in the Grand Canyon due to his commission by the Santa Fe Railroad. When he goes to the Grand Canyon, he is so inspired by what he sees. It was actually a group of five painters and also the associate director of the Toledo Museum of Art. And she wrote this wonderful article called A Pilgrimage. She talks about this kind of religious experience that the artists had when they first saw the canyon itself. And so what Dangerfield is after in these paintings is to create that sense of the spirit of the canyon itself. And so he calls these figures these sleeping Amazons of the canyon to talk about the vastness of that space and to use what we call an allegorical figure. An allegorical figure is typically a nude figure who represents an idea or a virtue or some type of thought. And here the allegorical figure represents the vastness of the canyon.
And that's definitely a very full sun, is that?
Yes, that is the full sun. And if you look, and this he does this also in The Genius of the Canyon, the more finished painting that you were mentioning. If you look at the Grand Canyon itself, can you see the buildings that are starting to grow up? So this idea of this being a celestial place and having a celestial city that kind of comes out of the experience of gazing at the canyon in all its grandness.
So this is actually Christ stilling the tempest.
We're looking at a painting that was done between 1905 and 1910, and this really represents the direct kind of religious experiences that Dangerfield was attempting to paint. A lot of people talk about religion in America, and specifically Protestantism, as fading at the turn of the century. But really, it was just transforming itself from being art being more didactic, illustrating a passage from the Bible, for example, to art becoming, at the turn of the century, about eliciting an emotion in the viewer themselves. And so in this painting of Christ stilling the tempest, what Dangerfield has attempted to do is to evoke through the waves and the movement of the water. You can see it actually spiraling where the bird is flying over top of it. And we see Christ in the bow of the boat that is cresting this wave and suggesting the roughness of the ocean. Again, he's using that really frenetic brushwork to suggest the aggressiveness of the ocean, and we have the setting sun as well. So what Dangerfield is after is not necessarily showing the miracle that Christ is performing in stilling the lake that they're on, but instead creating that sense of scariness that the disciples must have felt in that storm, and to know that there's going to be that comfort afterwards.
It's definitely the storm that he caught.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. That strong emotions that Dangerfield is after all the time.
Well, there are two paintings here that mention Westglow. One is Westglow itself, and one is on the porch at Westglow, so it looks like two points of view from the same building. What was Westglow to Dangerfield?
Westglow was actually his home in Blowing Rock, North Carolina. Dangerfield, although he moved to New York City in 1881, in 1886 he actually was ill, and his doctor suggested that he go into the countryside to get some air and sunshine. And while a lot of artists in New York would go to the mountains of New England or the shores and coast of New England, Dangerfield chose instead to go to his home state, which was North Carolina. And he continued to summer there, and he actually taught a summer school for women in the summer. And what he did was he created a series of homes, and Westglow is the last one, which was done in the Greek Revival style. Today it is Westglow Spa and Resort. It's a really magnificent space, and we've actually included on the label a contemporary photograph of the mansion. But Westglow was really a place to get away from the heat and confusion and cacophony of the city. And it was also through Dangerfield's moving to this place in the summer that he created an artist colony. And even today, artists go to Blowing Rock to paint. And what we find is the continuance of this interest of escaping the hurly-burly of the city to go into the fresh air of the country. And in the 19th century, this was in early 20th century, this was known as the back to nature movement, in which going out and being in nature could arouse a kind of emotional experience in the viewer that would be rejuvenating. And so what we see in the pastel above the painting of the mansion itself is a woman seated on the railing of a porch, and we can see her gazing out at nature. So she's having this kind of experience, an aesthetic experience, that then puts her onto another level beyond just the material world that she's looking at. And if you think about the kind of ways in which going to a park or going to a natural place can inspire this feeling within you, that's what Dangerfield is after in these paintings.
Well, it almost looks like she's looking at a moon, and that just might be because of the coloring of the pastels.
No, I think you're right. One of the things that Dangerfield was oftentimes did was he painted sunsets, he painted moons, and we'll see some more paintings with moons in them. You know, if you think of the kind of mystical feeling of a night with a full moon and that glow of light, that's really what he's after. Again, having these evocative moments, and certainly sunsets, again, they're so glorious. And the experience of looking at a sun setting, again, creates this emotion within you, or evokes an emotion within you. That's why he picks these really poignant moments to depict in his work.
Well, even with the pastels, he's managed to capture moon glow on the tips of the trees, on the portion of the flooring, on the railing. You just see a little bit of the reflection of the moon or the moon glow.
Yeah, exactly. And the medium of pastel really helps with that because he's using a chalk. Pastel, which basically pigment is mixed in with chalk, and when you scrape it or use it against the paper, it creates this kind of powdery effect, which adds to the glow of the moon that you're looking at.
Now, the painting before me, again, it's kind of muted in terms of the figures. It's not very well defined, except a portion of the animal is probably more defined than the human in this, and you have a field kind of reminiscent of something that is not quite there, but you know exactly what it is. The colors are vibrant greens in the field and the skies, but you still have this muted dark right in the center where the figures are.
Right. The painting is actually entitled Milkmaid, and it dates to around 1910. Here we see the strong influence of George Ennis, particularly, as you said, in this kind of hazy rendering, this loose, almost flickering brushwork on the canvas of the painting. This interest that George Ennis had is really, again, the influence of the Barbizon School, which formed in 1830. It was a French school. And what they were interested in was the lives of peasants and the simple religious life that peasants lived and the kind of simple spirituality. And so, again, we have one of these scenes in which we have a moon kind of coming out of the clouds. And typically, milking happened twice a day, at dawn and at dusk. And so we see her going out into the fields. There is a cow in the background. That's, yes, the strongest and most focused thing in the painting. But we also see that she's actually not looking at the cow, but looking out as if she's having a reverie in amongst this special moment that she looks out at. And if you look at the trees in the background, that very loose, almost hazy rendering of the trees is, again, very reminiscent of George Ennis. And we can see his mentor and friend's influence in this picture.
A decidedly full moon in this painting.
Yes, absolutely a full moon. This painting is entitled The Return at Twilight. So again, we have this, you know, dusk image, and it shows a young woman with her herding stick. She's holding a goose in her arms, and we can see the other geese gathered around her feet. And so this is a painting of a shepherdess who's tending to her flock. And we have that beautiful moon glow in the background to, again, evoke this really interesting, I guess we can say, landscape that we're looking at. Now, in the 19th century and early 20th century, this is actually painted in 1887, but at this time period, the Victorian viewers would have immediately seen the religious aspect to the painting. If you think about a shepherd tending to her or his flock, that's a direct reference actually to elements or actually moments in both the New and Old Testaments. And so in pictures like this, simple moonlit scapes again evoke the religious and the spiritual through their very subject matter.
I love how the reflection of the moon, the glow of the moon, is very obviously depicted on the side away from what you see.
Right, exactly. And you can see it kind of, there's a water feature in the middle of the painting, and it kind of hits that and glows. But if you also look, it's hitting the young shepherdess, and it kind of creates this halo-like effect around her face and the back of her head. It's kind of this luminosity that is suggested both in the figure and in the water.
Now, Mysterious Night, it almost looks like Birchfield. I mean, it's got an interesting twisted tree, very much dark night colors, but you can see just portions of what's going on here, a small fence, perhaps a downed tree and portions of trees, but it looks kind of frightening.
Yes, it is a scary painting, I think. It's actually a watercolor on board, and what we see Dangerfield really using to create this kind of scary image is the watercolor technique. He actually sanded the board to create a rough surface so that the paint actually soaks into the surface that much better. And it also, because of the roughness of the surface, it has a tendency, as the paint is absorbed, to very much veil the brushwork and to veil details, which adds to the mystery of the picture. And I think the kind of, yeah, you're not sure what's going to happen. There's a house in the background that the moon is reflecting off the roof of, and you're like, who lives in that house? And there, while there's an entree into the painting, there's also a fence that kind of keeps us from going into the space of the picture. Even the moon, and we have this rough, wild tree, which kind of partially blocks the moon itself. So it gives us this kind of sense of unease as we look at the picture.
And then we have a couple of rather large paintings that are very, very obviously religious works.
Yes, actually, what you're looking at are reproductions of two murals that Dangerfield began to paint in 1902, and one was completed in 1904 and the other one in 1905. They were commissioned by Haley Fisk, who at the time was the president of the Metropolitan Life Insurance Company in New York City, for the Church of St. Mary the Virgin, a Episcopal church that actually still is in Times Square. And the church itself very kindly sent me some of these details from their murals. The reason that I wanted to recreate this was to demonstrate how Dangerfield is actually an academic painter, that he begins his paintings by actually doing drawings. And so what I've arranged here on the walls are studies that he drew for the actual paintings themselves. So what we're looking at is a detail from the mural entitled The Epiphany. And if you look at the drawings to the left of the mural, you can actually see a nude study that he did of one of the wise men, and then a study of the drapery that the wise man is going on, and you can see the figure in red with the beard is the final product. Now, as you look at these drawings, you'll see that there are grids, and what Dangerfield would do is do the study, then he would lay a grid over it, and that would allow him to have the right scale when he reproduced it as a large painting. And to give you a sense of this, these figures are actually life-sized in the final mural. So these were enormous. And it really was, as one person said, the commission of a lifetime. It garnered an incredible amount of popularity and admiration, and this really helped to bolster Dangerfield's career. And he was very much, I should say, involved in the Church of St. Mary the Virgin. And so this for him was both, you know, an act of devotion, but also an act of love for the congregation that he was part of.
How long will the Dangerfield exhibit be available here at the Hunter Museum?
The exhibition is up through February the 21st of 2016.
And where do these works reside when they're not here?
The works are actually all on loan from the Morris Museum in Augusta, Georgia. The gift was given to the museum back in the 90s, and it actually came along with Dangerfield's papers, which are currently residing at the Center for Southern Art in Augusta. Now, we're very lucky because there are collectors here in Chattanooga, and three of the works are actually from their collection. And so it's wonderful to have that Chattanooga connection to the exhibition.
Seeking the Spiritual, the Visionary Art of Elliot Dangerfield is the special exhibition on view at the Hunter Museum of American Art through February 21st. For WUTC's Around and About, this is Rabbit.